Well, good evening, everybody. Good evening. If you'd open up a Bible to Hebrews chapter 4, that's where we're going to begin in just a moment. Hebrews, the fourth chapter. We've been working exclusively in the Gospels up until now, but I want to begin in Hebrews 4, and then we'll make our way back to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and we'll work out of the Gospels primarily for the next few minutes. As you're turning to Hebrews chapter 4, I will join in the welcome from earlier. It is great to see everybody tonight. Appreciate so much the fact that you're here. I know there's lots of other things that you could be doing on a Monday night, lots of good things that you could be doing on a Monday night, but I think you've maybe chose the better things, and that is to be involved in spiritual activities. Appreciate so much the good singing of those songs, the spirited and reverential way in which we sang those together, and the recognition that we are in the very presence of God this evening as we've come to be involved in His things. I have been tasked for the Monday night, Tuesday night, and Wednesday night slots to try and do something a little bit different. I guess I'm kind of being the guinea pig for maybe something a little bit different for a gospel meeting, and that is to not just stand up here and just be the only one talking for the entirety of the time. The elders have asked if maybe we could make this kind of a more of a Bible class type setting, and so I'm going to lay out some stuff here at the beginning. That way you need to know where it is that we're going and what it is that we're talking about. And then I do want to kind of break for some moments and offer some opportunities for others to offer their thoughts, especially for tonight's lesson, for what we're talking about, because I do think that lots of folks are going to have lots of things that they may want to contribute to the things we're going to be talking about tonight. We are talking this week, the theme for our week is the idea of being with Jesus in Acts, the fourth chapter. And in verse 13, the Sanhedrin council really kind of marveled when they observed some things about Peter and John, and the things about their conduct and how they spoke and the way they carried themselves caused them to recognize that these common and uneducated men, these guys had been with Jesus. And there's just something about that statement. The fact that the way that they lived just spoke volumes about who it is that they were most closely associated with. And that's the way that we want it to work in our lives, isn't it? We want people to see and observe the way that we live, and we want them to be able to say the same thing. You know what? That guy or that gal, they must be with Jesus. Jesus must be with them. That's a big part of their lives. And we're talking about ways in which we can learn from Christ by being around Christ in the Scriptures so that we can become more like Christ. And that'll be especially helpful this evening as we begin in Hebrews, the fourth chapter. Read with me, if you will, please, in verse 15. In Hebrews chapter 4 and in verse 15, there the Hebrew writer says, he says that we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. I don't know about the rest of you, but riding on an elevator is not my most favorite activity to be involved in the world. And it actually has nothing to do with the motion of the elevator, the going up and the going down and getting a sick or a queasy feeling from that. That's not really what bothers me or causes me troubles. What I tend to find very awkward and very difficult is riding in elevators with other people. It's the other people thing that makes elevators rides so awkward for me. Imagine you go to visit somebody at the hospital and you need to take the elevator to get up to their floor and to get to their room. Chances are, especially if you go to one of the hospitals here in Louisville, chances are you're probably going to end up taking a ride with a stranger or two or three or four or maybe even more. And I just always find that to be very odd and uncomfortable. Here I am in this small enclosed space with people that I really did not choose to be with. They don't know me, I don't know them, and we're going to now take this journey together. And yes, it is a relatively short journey, 30 seconds, 60 seconds, a couple of minutes at the most, but we're going to take this journey together in this small enclosed space, and we're going to do it together. And we may even, on the ride up, we may even pick up some additional folks and bring them into the midst. And all of that is just very weird to me. And it is made all the more difficult when you are in that confined space, and you are rubbing shoulders now with people that you've never even met before. I'm now touching them and they're touching me. And people that are very claustrophobic and maybe you're germophobes, they're probably really freaking out now trying to picture all of this in their mind. Or maybe now here somebody comes in and they're not really considerate of others and they're talking on their cell phone and talking at it at a normal voice and everybody else is, does this person not realize that we're here? Or when somebody comes in and maybe they've got some body odor rocking and that causes some problems in that small space. Or somebody brings their kid into the elevator and little Johnny wants to push all of the buttons all at the same time. You understand about that. when you are stuck in that environment, there is this feeling that, okay, we're all bonded together now, so what are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to say? If you're like me, I find that I gaze an awful lot at my shoelaces. I am very acquainted with my shoelaces because I tend to just kind of look down an awful lot. It's just a struggle to know how to act in that moment, what to say, because we've all been thrust together, and whether we like it or not, we are going to be taking this little journey together. Now, I say all of that to kind of set up this idea. In many ways, I think that that elevator ride really serves as an apt metaphor for what it is like sometimes in family. Families are people that we are stuck with for a relatively short journey, and sometimes it is a struggle to be cooped up together with them. Just think about it. Generally speaking, you didn't get to choose your family. Now, I'm very thankful that God chose my mom and my dad for me, but I didn't get any say in that. I didn't get to pick who my parents were. And in a sense, they didn't even get to pick me. They didn't know what they were getting until September the 1st, 1980. I made my arrival and boom, I got on the elevator with them. And for the past 39 years now, we've had to try to figure out how to make this work and take that ride together. I didn't have any choice when it came to who my siblings were. I'm really thankful for them, but I didn't get to choose them. They were thrust upon me. February of 1982, my brother Luke, he got on the elevator. August of 1984, my brother Aaron, he jumped on the elevator. October of 1985, my brother Ben got on the elevator. It's getting pretty cramped in here. We've got a lot of folks in here. And for all of the years since, we've had to try to figure out how to take this ride together. My wife, she didn't get to choose her in-laws. Now, she chose me. She knew what she was getting there. But when she chose to take the elevator ride of life with me, she also had to take all the rest of the crazy, kooky McKibben clan. That's just a package deal. It all just goes together. And the same thing goes for my in-laws and all the aunts and the uncles and the cousins. My cousin Katie is here this evening. She didn't get to pick me. I didn't get to pick her. All the other relatives, we've all packed together in this elevator, and we're trying to figure out how to do this thing called life, how to cooperate and how to communicate and work together. Here's the difference, though, in the hospital elevator and the family elevator. When people get off the elevator at the hospital, chances are I'm probably never going to see those people ever again. But that is not the case with family. We hop on the elevator of life with our family, and that's not just a 30 or 60 second ride, is it? No, it is a long ride. It can be a long adventure. And so since that's going to be a long ride, we want that ride to be as smooth and as pleasant and as problem-free as it possibly can be. We want our family dynamic to be as harmonious as, like we see in the old television shows, the Engle family, the Walton family, the Cleaver family. We want our family gatherings to look like those pristine Norman Rockwell Thanksgiving paintings where there's peace and unity and tranquility and laughter and joy, and yet all too often, it doesn't work out that way, does it? Because sometimes in families, we are stuck with difficult people. We are stuck with abrasive personalities. We are stuck with poor communicators. We are stuck with people who have very messy lives. And they bring all of those problems and all of those things, they bring them all onto the elevator, and it then makes it hard for all of us to be together. Maybe it's a dad who just keeps hounding you about when you're going to go out and get a real job. Maybe it's a mother who keeps comparing you to your sibling. Why can't you do as good as he or she does? Maybe it's an in-law who wonders, or maybe even just says out loud, why did my daughter marry you? I'm still trying to figure that out. I think all of us have experienced to some degree that kind of thing in our families, and let's be honest, it hurts, and it brings stress, and it brings anxiety, and it brings pain to our lives. And to complicate things even further, is when sometimes we have people in our families who are not Christians, who are not following Jesus Christ. They are not interested in living their lives according to the pattern of the New Testament. They are not people who are disciples, and they're not interested in spiritual things. In many ways, we are spiritually incompatible with these people, and that makes things difficult. Maybe we have a few things in common with them, but on this and on this, we're polar opposites. We're different in so many ways. And so since our values and our priorities and our outlook on life is so different from them, that unfortunately causes some friction and it causes some turmoil in the elevator. While some people here in the next couple of months, we're nearing holiday time, some people are really looking forward to being with their family here in November and December for all the holidays. But there are many others who are absolutely dreading this time of year because they know there's going to be conflict and they know it's going to be hard to be together with their family. The question is, what can we do about that? Where could we possibly turn for some guidance on that? We'd certainly turn to all kinds of pop psychologists. We could go to Dr. Phil and all these other kinds of folks, and they would certainly offer some ideas. But what if I told you this evening that Jesus could actually help us here? Would you believe me? That passage we just read in Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 15 says that Jesus can sympathize with just about anything that we experience in this life. That Jesus understands the struggles and the difficulties that we face because he's been there and he's done that. And I'm going to suggest to you this evening that Jesus actually can help us when it comes to dealing with difficult family members. It may surprise you to learn that Jesus had difficult family members. It may even surprise some of you to learn that Jesus had a family at all. But he did. He had a mother and a father. He had brothers and he had sisters. And in many ways, Jesus had more difficulties and more trouble with his relatives than any of us can even begin to imagine. Which is why I am going to invite you once again this week to come alongside and let's spend some time with Jesus. Of all of the dysfunctional families in the Bible that we could look at, I believe we can do no better than to consider the example of our Lord. Because if you were to say, and maybe you've even cried this out before, Lord, you just don't know what it's like. Lord, you don't know the difficulties and the pain that my family is causing me. You don't know my own flesh and blood, how they make life difficult and it's hard for us to be together. As soon as you tell Jesus that he doesn't know what that's like, Jesus is going to say, oh no, no, my child, I do know what that's like. He knows all about it and he is able to sympathize with our frustrations and our difficulties even more than we even recognize. Somebody maybe says, okay, Josh, what exactly are you talking about? What exactly did Jesus have to deal with in his family? I'd like for us to just take a couple moments and let's just kind of put the biblical data together, and that'll give us a good foundation to start with. Let's begin all that in Luke chapter 2. In Luke chapter 2, and let's just do some reading here in the Gospels. In Luke chapter 2, this is Jesus at a young age. This is Jesus at the age of 12. And he is in Jerusalem. And he is with his parents. And he is here for the Passover. And as far as I can tell, Jesus seemed to have the support of his mother Mary and his father Joseph. We don't know everything about the relationship that Jesus had with his parents, at least maybe not as much as we would like. Probably know a little bit more about his relationship with his mom than we do with his dad. However, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that it did seem like they had special consideration for what they realized was a very special son. But that doesn't mean that they always understood what Jesus was doing and what he was all about. Case in point, right here in Luke chapter 2. Look in Luke 2. Look down there toward the end of the chapter, verse 46. Luke 2, verse 46. After 3 days, they found him in the temple, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. And all who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. And when his parents saw him, they were astonished. And his mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us so? Behold, your father and I, we've been searching for you in great distress." And he said to them, "Why were you looking for me? Did you not know that I must be in my father's house?" And they, verse 50, they did not understand the saying that he spoke to them. And so even right here at a very early age, Jesus' family did not understand him. They didn't get it. And I'm going to guess this was the first of many occasions they didn't get it. The things that he was saying, the things that he was doing and occupying his time with. They just didn't get it. We just don't get you, Jesus. Can any of you all relate to that in your own family? Here you're trying to do something that's good, trying to do something that's right. And folks, even in your own family, they just totally misunderstand that. They misdiagnose that. They question your motives for why you're doing what you're doing. They maybe assume the absolute worst. Jesus, he knows what that feeling is like. Or how about this? What was Jesus' relationship like with his siblings? Look in John 7, please. In John 7, Mary and Joseph did have other children. How did they get along with their older brother Jesus? Well, in John chapter 7, Jesus is now an adult. His earthly ministry is in full swing. People are being amazed at his miracles and at his teaching. But how do his brothers and his sisters feel about him? John 7 shows us. John 7 verse 1, after this Jesus went about in Galilee, and he would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. So his brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works that you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." Verse 5, "For not even his brothers believed in him." They didn't believe in Jesus. In fact, that statement in verse 5 really helps you to understand the tone that they probably said, the things that they said in verses 3 and in verse 4. "Yeah, Jesus, I got a good idea for you. Go over to Judea. Yeah, they're really going to like you there. Go over there and tell them who you are and say all this stuff over there. Yeah, go preach over in Judea." That was not encouragement. In fact, what they're doing is they're ridiculing the very work that Jesus was trying to accomplish. Can you relate to that? When the people who ought to be the biggest supporters in your life, they do not believe in you. They do not instill confidence in you, but instead they scoff and they belittle and they discourage. That hurts. That hurts a lot, especially coming from people that you grew up with. These are his siblings. These are the people that he spent time with from a wee little lad all the way up, and they're just not really on the same page with you. How about in Mark chapter 3? Let's add this episode in Mark chapter 3. In Mark 3, we read once again about the popularity of Jesus. And we're told that that popularity reaches such extreme proportions that we're told in Mark chapter 3, beginning in verse 20, "Then he went home, and the crowd gathered again so that they could not even eat." Just lots of people, verse 21 now. "But when his family heard it, they went out to seize him, for they were saying, 'He is out of his mind.'" Can you hear them saying this, maybe to their mother? "Mom, Jesus is off the deep end. You should hear what he's doing and what he's saying, what other people are thinking about him." Somebody maybe asked me the other day, "Why haven't we done something with Jesus? He's acting like a crazy person. He's acting like a lunatic. It's just embarrassing." Jesus' family, to some degree, was ashamed of him. And maybe it was the zeal that Jesus demonstrated for spiritual things. Maybe that was just very off-putting for them, made them uneasy. Maybe the fact that Jesus was going and he was ruffling the feathers of the religious elite and he was trading barbs with the scribes and the Pharisees and all of those, maybe that made his family really uncomfortable. Instead of them being proud of Jesus for his convictions and for his courage, they instead were mortified. You ever have loved ones treat you that way? My family would probably tell you they are embarrassed of me way more than they care to admit some of the goofy things that I do. I'm talking about a more extreme form of embarrassment. Maybe embarrassed to even be identified with you. Ashamed for people to know that you're related to them. Maybe the fact that you are a person who is full of fervor and commitment for the Lord, and everything in your life, it revolves around this. And it revolves around being a disciple of Jesus. That just maybe creates some real tension for those in your family who are not Christians, who are not interested in doing all of that. It's really off-putting to them. The fact that you're into this stuff and you're not as much into that stuff out there, maybe they just don't get it. And so in the family, you're looked at as being kind of the religious fanatic. You've been on the receiving end of that kind of thing? If so, you're not alone, because Jesus had to deal with that. Let me add one more to this list. Look in Luke chapter 4. In Luke chapter 4, this is Jesus in the city of Nazareth, meaning this is where Jesus grew up. This is hometown. These are the people who would have known him and would have known his family in a very, very personal and intimate way. People maybe see Jesus come back into town. "Hey, look, it's the carpenter's kid. Man, I remember when he was just knee-high to a grasshopper and he's in there working in his daddy's workshop." Or, you know, "There's Jesus. Yeah, he used to hang out with my kids and used to play when he was little." These are the people who should have been the most warm and the most receptive when Jesus comes back home. And so we're told in verse 16 of Luke chapter 4 that Jesus enters into the synagogue on the Sabbath day. And he gets up to read scripture. He reads from what we would know as being Isaiah 61. And at the conclusion of that reading, Jesus says in verse 21, he says, you all have just seen me fulfill this prophecy. That's talking about me. And after trying to elaborate on that maybe a little bit further, but to certainly help those who would have been shocked by all of that, notice what's said then in verse 28, in Luke chapter 4, verse 28. When they heard these things, all in the synagogue were filled with wrath, and they rose up. And they drove him out of the town, and they brought him to the brow of the hill on which their town was built, so that they could throw him down the cliff. But passing through their midst, he went away. What a horrible scene this is. Imagine Jesus' neighborhood friends and his acquaintances growing up. They're now trying to kill him, trying to shove him off a cliff. Did you notice, though, what's missing from that verse? Something that is absent from that verse that ought to be there? Verse 29, that verse ought to say, they brought him to the brow of the hill so that they could throw him down the cliff. But then Jesus' brothers came to the rescue and stopped them from doing that. That's what the text ought to say, but it doesn't. Because when Jesus was in trouble, what we find time and time again is that his brothers and the rest of his family, they actually often were not there to defend him. They did not vouch for him. They did not back and support his work. And that's obviously due to the first three things. They didn't understand what he was doing. They didn't believe in him. They were even ashamed to be associated with him. In fact, at the cross, when Jesus is dying, where is his family? His mother's there, but where are his brothers? No indication that his brothers were there, or his sisters, or any of the other folks in his family. Has that ever happened to you? When you're doing something, dealing with something, and you're just sure that if nobody else can be relied upon to be there, my family's going to be there for me. My family's absolutely going to have my back there. They're going to be right there by my side, but then right in the critical moment when you need them the very most, you turn around and there's no one to be found. They didn't show up, and now you're left disappointed, and you're left hurt. I'll say again, Jesus has felt that pain. As soon as you start talking about and swapping stories about how horrible things are in your family, pretty soon Jesus is going to come along and peck you on the shoulder and he's going to say, I understand about that. I know exactly what you're going through. I've had to deal with some difficult relatives myself. Which prompts the question that I think we really want to know the answer to, and that is, Jesus, how'd you deal with that? What did you do? How did you deal with the unpleasantness that sometimes arises when you got all these different personalities and ideas and problems packed into that elevator? Lord, show me how to deal with family difficulties in a way that is wise and in a way that will honor and glorify you. In fact, show me how to be Christ-like in how I deal with my family. Let me pause for a second. Let me go back. Those were the four major instances that I was really aware of in the New Testament of Jesus' encounters with his families and some of the difficulties that he faced. Were there some others that anybody else is aware of, or that maybe they'd like to contribute to the discussion of some things that Jesus had to deal with his family that would be worth us considering for a moment? Oh, yeah. That's right. And I'm glad you actually said what you said, because I actually think that's probably one of the first things that we ought to take a cue from Jesus about. And that is that Jesus, I think, was fully prepared for the possibility that family members were not always going to act the way that you would expect family members to act. That misunderstanding that he experienced, that unbelief, that ridicule that he experienced, I don't think Jesus was surprised by that. I don't think, well, I was just totally taken off guard. I didn't expect my family to act that way. No, Jesus knew up front that there was a chance that some of his family members, they would not appreciate him. They would not embrace him the way that you would expect. He knew that before he ever even put skin on and came and stepped foot on this earth. He readied himself for the very real possibility that sometimes your kinfolk is going to let you down. And that is exactly why Jesus then tells you and me and anybody else who would ever choose to be one of his followers, is that you need to brace yourself for the possibility of friction within your earthly family. Let's look in Matthew chapter 10. In Matthew chapter 10, let's just hear that straight from the source. In Matthew chapter 10, this is a passage that I'm guessing probably is not going to be printed on the inside of anybody's holiday greeting cards this year when they send to their family. And you'll see why. Look in Matthew chapter 10, look in verse 34. In Matthew 10, verse 34, Jesus says, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies will be those of his own household." Jesus says that sometimes when a person professes their allegiance to me, when I then get brought into that person's family, they load me onto that elevator, watch out. Because civil war is liable to break out. The rest of those family members that are in the elevator, they may not share those same convictions. They may not even respect those convictions. That's kind of what we hope in a bare minimum sense, that even if our family doesn't agree with us on certain things, that if nothing else, they'll at least respect our convictions. But sometimes that's just not going to happen. And that's going to create some real problems. And Jesus says, don't be surprised by that. Look at verse 37. He continues on. He says there, "Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Aren't you glad Jesus tells us that up front? He lets us know what we're getting into whenever we choose to be with him and cast our lot with him. I remember hearing once a preacher was telling about these two sisters that were baptized. There was a couple of teenage girls that they'd been studying with and coming to church with a couple of the boys at church, and these two girls were ultimately baptized into Christ. And almost immediately upon making that decision to obey the gospel, when their parents found out about this, their parents just began making all kinds of problems, causing all kinds of trouble with that. They didn't like the fact that their daughters had done that. Didn't like the fact that their daughters were going down there to that church. Almost immediately, just within just a few days of the trouble starting, one of those sisters, she just renounced her decision to be baptized into Christ and said she had regretted it and just didn't want to be a part of the church anymore, just didn't want to do that anymore. The other sister, though, she remained steadfast. She stood firm. The preacher then went to talk to that faithful sister. And as he was talking with her, he was just so apologetic to her, trying to tell her, I'm so sorry this has happened to you. I'm so sorry that you're having to deal with this and having to go through all of this. Until finally that young lady, she said, "Preacher, just stop. Stop. You don't have to apologize. You don't have to try and make me feel better. You don't even need to say anything. Because my Lord said that if my family members, if they don't accept him, then that means they don't accept me. And that means they are not worthy." And you know what? As painful as it is to say that, that's exactly right. Oftentimes, our family is going to be the very last place we can go to get the support that we need to do what we know is right. Look in Mark 6. Let me add to that in Mark 6. Here is this occasion of Jesus coming to his hometown. And once again, he doesn't get a hero's welcome. They're not lining the streets. "Oh, yes, I'm so glad Jesus is here." No, look at the reception that he gets in Mark 6. Look in verse 3. People were saying, Mark 6, verse 3, "Is not this the carpenter, the son of Mary, and the brother of James, and Joseph, and Judas, and Simon? And are not his sisters here with us?" And they took offense at him. And Jesus said to them, "A prophet is not without honor, except in his hometown, and among his relatives, and in his own household." There you have it. Jesus says, sometimes family doesn't give you what you need. They will let you down from time to time. And guess what? Don't be surprised when that happens. It's going to happen. In fact, I was kind of talking with Randy before services about the subject matter for this evening. And if there's anybody here this evening who's thinking, "Oh, this lesson doesn't apply to me. My family's perfect. We all get along. There's never any troubles." I would like to meet you. I'd like to meet your family. I'd like to find this perfect family that apparently exists. But it doesn't exist. Jesus tells us these things up front so that we are prepared to deal with them in the right way. And one of the very best ways that Jesus dealt with those difficult relatives was, secondly, he didn't try to force a change on them. Jesus knew that you cannot twist people's arm and force them to change. And so Jesus never tried doing that. Look in Matthew 10 with me. In Matthew chapter 10, Jesus is about to send out the 12 apostles. And before doing so, he gives them these important instructions. In Matthew chapter 10, this is verse 12. In Matthew 10 and in verse 12, Jesus says, "As you enter into a house, greet it. And if the house is worthy, let your peace come upon it. But if it is not worthy, let your peace return to you. And if anyone will not receive you or listen to your words, shake off the dust from your feet when you leave that house or that town. Jesus says, if folks don't want the gospel, if folks are not interested in that, if they don't want to hear what you have to say and what you have to offer, then leave. Shake the dust off your feet. Get out of that place. Don't stay there and try to overstay your welcome. Don't try to coerce. Don't try to manipulate. Don't try to force people into accepting something they don't want. If they don't want it, they don't want it. And you know what? Doesn't do any good to try and force it upon them. Have you ever given any thought to the fact that if Jesus could not force his family to share his convictions and to do what was right, what makes us think that we can do that with our family members? How arrogant do we have to be to think that we can somehow force our family members to do the right thing and make them do what we want them to do? Make no mistake about it, Christians are placed upon this earth to share and to lead and to invite and to influence. That's called being the salt of the earth and the light of the world. But we are not here to push. And sometimes I am afraid that our desire, our strong desire to bring about a change in the lives of our loved ones, sometimes that desire is so strong that we end up speaking when we should have been silent. We ended up being harsh when we should have been gentle. We end up pushing when we should have been setting a quiet example. In fact, isn't that why Peter says what he says in 1 Peter chapter 3 about the believing wife and how she can affect an unbelieving husband? That's not accomplished by force. That doesn't happen by nagging or guilt trips or berating him. No. No, that's able to come about by a respectful and pure conduct, a quiet and gentle spirit. 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1, 2, 3, and 4. Sometimes what we need to do is we need to just back off. In fact, I want to say this especially right now to our sisters, to the ladies. Ladies, quit trying to fix everybody. It seems to be a thing that's just kind of common amongst women, I've noticed. Don't think you're going to be Florence Nightingale for everybody in your family. You just can't. You're not going to be able to fix everybody. Instead, let's just let our light shine for Christ. Let's be the kind of person that we're supposed to be, and let's just pray that God will be patient and God will work within His providence, that they will then be changed by His grace and by His love. But you know what? I need to say kind of closely connected to this. For just as much Jesus didn't try to force a change on His family members, it also needs to be pointed out thirdly, that He didn't allow His family members to change Him. Now, I want to be clear here. I am not suggesting that we do not ever need to be open to other ideas. I'm not suggesting that we need to be so closed-minded that we never accept fault for things that we mess up. Sometimes when we're talking about the difficult family member, sometimes it's the person in the mirror. But sometimes we need to be willing to admit guilt and our share in causing those problems. But that's really not what I'm talking about here with this point. What I'm talking about is when you know that you are right because the Scriptures show that you are right, and you know that you are right with God, and you know that you are right where God wants you to be, I'm saying to you this evening, don't move. Do not let your love and your affection for a family member move you from doing what you know is right and what you should do. Do not ever allow that to cause your faith in the Lord and your service to the Lord to be wavered at all, to be compromised. Jesus never did that. I am sure that Jesus wanted very much for His family to accept Him and to embrace Him and to believe in Him, but Jesus never allowed those folks to change Him. He never did it at that price. He kept doing the will of God despite their unbelief. Look at Luke 14. These are the words that Jesus spoke. And it makes clear that He expects that very same kind of dedication and commitment out of us, His followers. In Luke 14, this is verse 26. Jesus says here, Luke 14, 26, if anyone comes to Me and does not hate his own father and mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, he cannot be My disciple. Sometimes people have trouble with that verse. New Christians especially, maybe reading that verse for the very first time. I'm supposed to hate my mother? Hate my father? Hate my siblings? Really? No. No, not in the sense that you and I often use the word hate. What Jesus means is that the love that we have for father and mother and brother and sister, that it is less than the love that we have for Him. In fact, if you could put those two kinds of love, love for our family and love for Jesus, if you could put it on some kind of a scale, then the difference between your love for Christ and your love for your family, the difference would be so great that it would be like the difference between love and hate. There's just that great of a chasm, that great of a difference between the two. And so Jesus says, your love for me, it must be an unrivaled and unmatched love. Nothing else can even come close to it. And I'm going to tell you this evening, as much as I love my wife and as much as I'm missing her these few days, it cannot hold a candle to the love that I have for Jesus. As much as I love my daughter and my unborn child, it cannot compare to the love that I have for Jesus. My commitment to Him must be undeterred, it must be unswayed by any earthly relationship, family or otherwise. That is the depth of commitment that the Lord is calling for. That I am just so steadfast in my service to Him that there is no parent, there is no child, there is no sibling, there is no anybody that can change my relationship with Jesus the Christ. And let me pause right there. Thoughts, ideas, comments, applications, commendations, lamentations. What do you got? Yes, ma'am. A man on a mission. That's right. Jesus was undeterred. He was unswayed. God had given him a mission. God had given him a work. And in the very same sense, God has given us a mission and a work, and we cannot be deterred by that. As much as we'd love to be able to get on the same page with sometimes these difficult family members, the priority, the primacy of the kingdom, that always has to be at the forefront. What else here? Yes, sir, brother. That's right. I have so much I want to say about that, but I need to save it for the end. But I'll just amen what you did say. Thank you. Anything else? Let's move on. Let's think about this. Jesus did not make it his priority and his mission to seek to please his family. That's one of the ways that he dealt with the difficulties of family. I want to say this very, very candidly. If your mission in life is to please people, to make people happy, then you're always going to be held in bondage to other people's opinions. When I first started preaching, I'm pretty sure, looking back now, and I probably still struggle with it to some degree, but in the beginning, I was very much a slave to everybody else's opinion. If somebody thought that my preaching wasn't as good as Brother So-and-so, well, I wanted to be like Brother So-and-so. If somebody came to me and said, Josh, you need to stop doing some of this, I stopped doing some of that. If you need to start doing more of this, Josh, I started doing more of that. Until finally, I kind of came to realize that there's no way that I'm going to be able to please all of these people, all of these different masters. What I need to do is I need to just focus on trying to please the one master, the only master, and that is my Father in heaven. And that is exactly what Jesus patterned for us. Look in John chapter 8. In John chapter 8, as Jesus is addressing this audience here at the temple, he says to them in verse 29, in John chapter 8 and in verse 29, Jesus says there that he who sent me is with me. He has not left me alone, for I always do the things that are pleasing to him. And that is what it is all about, isn't it? Who are we trying to please? We're trying to please the Lord. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 9, Paul says that whether we are at home or whether we are away, we make it our aim to please him. In fact, I'll show you another verse. Look in Galatians 1. In Galatians 1, Paul says there that when you try to be a people pleaser, you're going to run into a really big problem. In Galatians 1 and in verse 10, Paul says there, "For am I now seeking the approval of man or of God? Or am I trying to please man? If I were still trying to please man, I would not be a servant of Christ." When you're all consumed with trying to make people happy, Paul says, you can't be who you're supposed to be as a Christian. Your service to Jesus is going to be impeded. It's going to be hindered. And as much, and I say all of that to say this, as much as we would like to please and gain the approval of our loved ones, of our relatives, young people, sometimes young people are fighting and clawing to get the approval of mom and dad, and I understand about all of that. In the grand scheme of things, though, what other people think, how other people feel about us, it is ultimately irrelevant. I'm seeking the Lord's approval. That needs to be at the top of the list. Which leads right to this fifth observation from Jesus' life. And that is, when Jesus' family members, when they did treat him wrong, he never retaliated at that mistreatment. This is so key. Look in 1 Peter chapter 2. In 1 Peter chapter 2, we often read this passage, and what we think about in our mind is we think about all of the abuse and the hostility that Jesus received from his enemies. You know, the Sanhedrin council and all of his crucifiers. But don't forget that some of Jesus' own family, they could actually be included in this verse. In 1 Peter chapter 2, I'm reading here in verse 21. 1 Peter 2 verse 21, Peter writes this, "For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth." And he goes on to talk about when he was reviled, he didn't revile again. When he suffered, he did not threaten again. Jesus did not retaliate. Jesus did not trade jabs. Have you ever thought about the fact that if anybody could have ever chosen the exact right words to just cut people down, I mean just slice and dice people and it just go in the most perfect way, humble people, bring them to their knees, it's Jesus. He could have done that all the time. But he didn't. In fact, the older I get, the more I am impressed with Jesus' willpower and his restraint to not be involved in that. Maybe what Jesus shows us here is that sometimes we're just going to be willing to take it on the chin. And that's hard to say, but it is. I know oftentimes we feel justified to just kind of shoot back. We're going to do to them what they did to me, only worse, and especially with family members. If you can't fight with your family, well, who can you fight with? I understand the temptation there. But 1 Peter 2 verse 21 says, "We have been called to look at the example of Jesus so that you might follow in his steps." You bite your tongue. Count to 10. Say a prayer. You do something. Do whatever it takes, because Jesus endured hostility from those who were against him, and that included from time to time his family, and he simply entrusted himself to the Father who would take care of the rest. We need to have the same attitude and spirit to do the same. I'm going to pause one more time before I get to this last idea. What else can we say here? Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. In a sense, you know, the apostles were, I imagine he kind of looked at them as being, as brothers in a sense, and maybe even in a deeper sense than his own family. In fact, in some ways, I almost think the relationship between Jesus and Peter was kind of like, you know, an older brother and the little brother who just can't seem to get it right, and he's always having to kind of bring him along. Jesus was always patient and tried to work with people and recognize that everybody's growing and try to understand why they do the things that they do from time to time. We got to be willing to do that. What else? We wrap it up with this last one. And this last one is the big one. And our brother Morris there has already kind of let the cat out of the bag on this, but I want to kind of punctuate it and bring us to this climactic point. And that is, one of the ways that Jesus was able to deal with difficult family members was that he knew who true family was. Let's go to that passage that it was referenced there a moment ago in Mark chapter 3. In Mark chapter 3, we read a section of this earlier when the family members, they came seeking for Jesus and they were saying, "He's out of his mind. We got to go get him and take him home and put a straitjacket on him. Bless his heart, he doesn't know what he's doing." Well, that story resumes at the end of the chapter in Mark chapter 3 and in verse 31. In Mark chapter 3 and in verse 31, his mother and his brothers came, and standing outside, they sent to him and they called him. "Hey, Jesus, come on. Time to come home now." Verse 32. And a crowd was sitting around him, and they said to him, "Your mother and your brothers, they're outside, they're seeking you." And he answered them, "Who are my mother and my brothers?" And you could probably imagine just a collective gasp from the audience. What, did he just say that? Who are my mother and my brothers? And looking about at those who sat around him, he said, "Here are my mother and my brothers. For whoever does the will of God, he is my brother and sister and mother." What is true family? Is it those folks that we're stuck on the elevator with? No. I'm not even there on the elevator long enough to even feel like family with those folks. What is true family? Is it the people who happen to share the same last name as I have? Well, not necessarily. According to Jesus, true family are the people who do God's will. That's the people that are family, because those are the people I'm going to be spending eternity with. That's true family. Now, I want to qualify all that by saying I am not trying to diminish the value and the blessing and the importance of our earthly physical families. God is very pro-family. He gave us these physical bonds, these blood bonds that we have, and it is a wonderful blessing. But is anybody familiar with the rope illustration? You ever seen that video that Francis Chan does? Francis Chan's a denominational preacher, and he did this illustration. You look it up on YouTube. I thought it was a great illustration. He described our lives and he described eternity like a rope. That imagine that this rope that just goes on, I don't know how long this is. Andy brought me this right before services. But imagine this rope just continues on and on and on and on. And it represents eternity. However, right here at the beginning of this rope, this little bit section here, I painted it yellow. You probably can't see that. But that little bit of yellow section, that represents your time here on this earth. 60, 70, 80, 90, 93, 94 years. However long the Lord allows us to live on this earth. And then there's this little, I made a little black dot here. That little black dot that's in the middle of that little yellow spot, that represents our family. Now let me ask you, do you imagine that after we have been in heaven for 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 10,000 years, do you imagine that any of us are going to look back and we're going to say, "Oh man, you remember back there? You remember that yellow spot? Remember that little black sliver? That was my family. That was my family there on earth, and oh man, it was so great. That's what it was all about." Do you really imagine that that's the way we're going to look at that? I don't think so. Family is who you're going to be spending all of eternity with. I want my dad to be in that family. I want my mom to be in that family. And by the grace of God, at this point in time, they are. I want my brother Luke, my brother Aaron, my brother Ben to be in that family. I want my wife Tiffany to be in that family, and they are. And when the day comes, I want my daughter Hattie and my unborn child to be in that family as well. I want all of my earthly relatives to be in that family. But I'm going to say this, if they don't serve Jesus, they are not my family. And I realize that sounds very harsh. If you're visiting this evening and you've never even been exposed to this stuff in the Word of God, that probably sounds very abrasive to you. But Jesus says that true family are the ones you're going to be with eternally. That's who your family is. And when you have been with the people of God forever and ever and ever and ever, you're just not going to look back at all these people right back here in that little bitty spot who didn't care one bit for God, didn't give a second thought to His Word. You're not going to be looking back at them and saying, "Oh, now that was my family." No, they're not. That's why Jesus says we need to get a lock on who true family is. And when we get a lock on that, we then need to lean in to that family. And I got to tell you, it's been my observation. We've had several here in the last couple of years at Lakeside. Several folks that have come from very awful family backgrounds that have come to learn the truth, and they have rendered their obedience to Christ, and they have been added to the family of God. And I got to tell you, those folks who have miserable pasts, I think they understand this better than even the rest of us do. They get it. I sat in an assembly right next to a young man just last year, and he sat during the Lord's Supper and he wept openly as he contemplated all that God had done for him and how far He had brought him. And I went to him after services and I said, "Cain, I said, are you okay, man? I just wanted to make sure that everything was all right. I saw you just weeping, just couldn't contain yourself." And he said, "Brother, I'm okay." He said, "I am more than okay. I just got, as we were taking the supper, I got to thinking about all that God had done for me. Because I didn't have a real family growing up. My mother was a drug addict, and my father was in jail. And I just kind of floated from one place to the next. But then I found the Lord. You know what He gave me? He gave me a family. I now have a father who does love me, and he cares for me, and he provides for me, and he sustains me each day. I have an older brother in Jesus, and he saves me, and he strengthens me, and he mediates on my behalf. I have untold other brothers and sisters who encourage me, and they admonish me, and they walk with me throughout life. I have a family. And I'm saying to you tonight that when your earthly family fails you, when they hurt you, when they let you down, and it will happen, I want you to remember what Jesus says in Mark chapter 3. Here is my brother. Here is my sister. Here is my mother. This is my family. It is those who do the will of God. That's your family. And that'll help you. I believe Jesus shows us it'll help us. Now let me close with one final verse. I'm going to put it on the screen. You don't need to turn to it in your Bibles. It's in Acts chapter 1. When we read about the disciples, how they are waiting in the city of Jerusalem, exactly as Jesus had instructed them to do, as He ascended back into heaven and they're awaiting the next thing that's going to happen, the Holy Spirit's going to guide and direct them in what they're to do. But we're told this in Acts chapter 1 and in verse 14. We're told in Acts chapter 1 and in verse 14 that these all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with His brothers. Do you see it? Those very ones who once upon a time had misunderstood Him, the ones who did not believe in Him, the ones who in various ways had given Him a hard time, Jesus' difficult family members, eventually, they got on board. They ended up becoming pillars in the early church. Those ones who once pitied Him, they now praise Him. The ones who once mocked Him, they now bow down in service to Him. And I cannot help but think that at least part of that change was brought about by the way that Jesus dealt with them, the way that He worked with them, the way that He just continued to set the example for them. As one writer put it, he said, Jesus gave them space and God gave them grace. Jesus helps us with our families, doesn't He? What do you think about God's family? As our brother said a moment ago, this family is not perfect. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that things are always perfect and there's never any problems, there's never any hiccups and bumps along the way when you're in God's family. That would be a lie. But our Father is perfect. Our older brother, Jesus, is perfect. The rest of us are imperfect. My question is, are you willing to take an elevator ride all the way to heaven with this family? This group of imperfect people, let us help you, and you help us. We're bound for heaven, and we want you to jump on and come too. If you have never submitted to Jesus Christ, rendered your obedience to the gospel, confessed Him as God's Son, repented and turned from sin and turned to the Lord, never been baptized in water for the remission of your sins, you can do that this evening. We'd love nothing more than to assist you in becoming a Christian. You do that, God will add you to His family. If you are in the family, but you've not been living like a family member in God's family ought to act, maybe you've been a prodigal son or a prodigal daughter, then brother or sister, we are beckoning you. The Lord is calling you to come back to Him. He is patiently waiting at the door to receive you, to forgive you, if you will repent and humble yourself before Him. If there's anybody here this evening who needs to get right with God and be right in the family, then do something about that right now while we stand and while we sing.